the UCR Podcast.
The first time I heard Counting Crows Like You, it was probably hearing their single Mr. Jones on the radio. And more than 30 years later, my memory is a little bit fuzzy as far as what happened next. But I can tell you this, I heard Round Here, the opening track on the band's 1993 debut album, August and Everything After. And I knew that I had discovered the music of a group that was going to be very special to me. Mr. Jones was a fun song, but Round Here unlock something completely different. During today's conversation with Adam Duritz, you'll hear the interesting way that I first heard the songs from their second album, Recovering the Satellites, and from there, the music never stopped. I have purchased every Counting Crows album as it's hit the proverbial shelves. I think that in some ways, they're one of the more underrated bands of the 90s, which is a strange thing to say about a group that had a lot of hits on the radio, but I don't think I'm alone in that opinion. Everyone is going to get more of an in-depth look inside the story of Counting Crows later this year, thanks to a new documentary, Counting Crows, Have You Seen Me Lately?, the latest entry in HBO's Music Box series of films that documents the emotional journey that Adam Duritz and the band took as a result of their success with August and Everything After. The documentary is set to premiere in June at the Tribeca Film Festival, and then will screen on HBO later in the year. Right now, fans can enjoy the group's newest album, Butter Miracle, The Complete Suites, which arrived earlier this month, and they'll be back out on the road in June for the Complete Suites tour with the Gaslight Anthem supporting, and that is the reason for our conversation today. Adam joins us to discuss the new album and some of the stories behind its creation. In the opening moments of the interview, we talk about concert bootlegs, and there's actually a great profile in GQ that happened after I had spoken with Adam, where the writer describes the living room of Adam's condominium in detail, and his wall of concert bootlegs gets a special mention. Now I need to see a picture of this wall, folks. Anyway, fellow fans will want to check it out. He spoke with Duritz for 10 hours, and it's a great story. It's Matt Wardlaw. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, please rate and review if you enjoy it, and follow us so you will get subsequent episodes of the podcast as they are released. And of course, for all things Counting Crows, visit their official website at countingcrows.com and get out to a show this summer. You don't want to miss these guys. Here's our conversation with Adam Duritz. You and I have talked a good amount over the years, and it made me think of one particular time that we spoke when we were doing the Outlaw Roadshow tour. We talked about a lot of current bands you were into at the time. As we wrapped, you asked me for my email because you were going to send me music from those bands. So I've always appreciated that at the core, you're a music fan. And something that we haven't talked about, I remember hearing way back that you were, you know, growing up into concert bootlegs, like Springsteen probably would be one. So I just wondered what your memories are of that period for you as a music fan. Like, were you trading cassettes with people? Like, what did all that kind of look like at the time?
Well, not so much growing up as like, I had some growing up, but they tended to not be as good back when they were doing it on vinyl and the cassettes, you know.
Sure.
But certainly during the period of my career, there were a good 10 or 20 years where bootlegs were really cool. You know, the packaging that came out with some of the companies. I mean, I have a wall of CD bootlegs here, like a whole wall of it. I got a ton of Dylan bootlegs, a ton of Springsteen bootlegs, a ton of Radiohead, really great Radiohead bootlegs, bunch of Roy Harper and Robin Hitchcock, a lot of Joni stuff. Trying to think what else. Got some good Oasis ones, a bunch of great Zeppelin bootlegs. Trying to think what else. Who else had great bootlegs? Neil Young, a lot of really good live Neil Young stuff. I got really obsessed with it. I had a friend who was a bootlegger who died a few years ago, but he used to show up at our concerts and he would just open up his trunk and he would have all these crates, thousands and thousands of bootlegs, and he would bring it in and it would be like a flea market in our dressing room, you know? And everyone would come by and be like flipping out over it. Or Immer and I would go to his house and go through. He made them himself too, Johnny Legs. He was great. You know, and there were a lot of record stores in New York back then too that sold them. So you could find really cool stuff. There's a lot of great REM stuff. I'm spacing on the rest of it now. But yeah, I really love that, because the thing is, as a music fan, when you love a band, you've probably got the records, you know? So what else can you, what else can you collect after that? You know, what else can you explore? You know, they only make records every so often, but they play concerts all the time. Little Feat has a lot of great bootlegs because they were a great live band. The band as well. A lot of really good Elvis Costello ones too. My favorite bootlegs ever probably are the Blue Nile. I had some really good Blue Nile bootlegs. That's also one of my favorite concerts I ever saw. Yeah, because it was such, there was so much more inspiration to be gleaned from the live shows because, you know, once you've got the records, you listen to them over and over and over again, but how much more are they, you know, like you can't get a lot. There's not going to be a million more records because people don't make them that often. So bootlegs were a great way to explore your favorite bands, you know, and, you know, you go to a great concert, but it's only one night, but they might have recorded every night on the tour. You know what I mean? You could get a bunch of that stuff. Yeah. So I really loved that. It was just so rewarding. And there was so much to be enjoyed and appreciated. And it wasn't until years later too, that like people like Dylan started putting out the bootleg series where you could, you know, get a lot of this unreleased stuff. But before that, you really had to go look for it yourself. I suppose that Biograph collection he put out was really the first one that was a publicly available bootleg that way, you know.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, now like things that we were searched for years are just available. You know, like you would look for, people made bootlegs that collected all the songs that would have made up the record Smile, you know, by the Beach Boys. But that's the kind of thing that the record companies at this point have put that out. And the same thing for like Dylan in 66, that tour where he used electric and acoustic, you know, the entirety of that I had on the bootlegs. And then later on you got it, you know, from Dylan himself, put it out as a box set, which is great. I mean, I love box sets, but before that stuff was available as box sets, you had to go, you know, find it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Bootlegs had it, you know?
Yeah. And that seems like, you know, it must have been pretty instructive for you, you know, with the way you guys kind of structure your set list. And I mean, this has been this way for a long time, but like maybe it gets amplified a little bit because you guys were, you know, one of the earlier bands to kind of start, you know, putting out official downloads of every show that you play. And so certainly as a fan, like you understood the appeal in that, but you know, understanding that you guys already had kind of a unique approach as a band, like how much did the idea of that, like kind of make you kind of start even thinking about the set list more from that point?
Well, I mean, one thing, you know, you realize from a lot of those bootlegs is that they may have played the same set every night. A lot of those bands,
sure,
you know, but they still did it a little differently and it's still really cool. You know, for me, it was just kind of that I've always thought that like the people were making a mistake that were really precious about not allowing people to record at concerts. Because the truth is those people who are coming to your concert to record, they've bought all your albums. They probably have multiple copies because they have CDs in different cars. You know what I mean? Like that, you know, those people aren't ripping you off. They're just going to promote the fact that you're great live. And so I always felt like we should let people record at concerts because all it is a free commercial for how good we are live. And the more that gets out there, the more people want to come to concerts. I never felt like it was going to detract from ticket sales or anything like that. I thought it would promote them. It was like, you know, it's the same thing with the internet. You've got this, in the years before that, everybody was really precious about trying to protect everything that belonged to them. But, and that may have come more from the record companies trying to do that. But the internet is a free way to connect to everyone in the world at the same time, you know? And like, I've kind of felt like everything you could do to get past the gatekeepers was a good idea. Let people record your concerts, put stuff out on the internet for free, whatever, you know, like just,
yeah.
Cause I was, as a music geek, I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a couple more things I'm going to move into talking specifically about the record. But, you know, you just made me think of something, just, you know, stuff being out there. You know, when you guys were about to put out Recovering the Satellites, you did some shows, I think, leading up to that where you played the entire record. And I can remember, like, you know, not too long, like maybe a week or so after one of those shows had happened, somebody sends me like a DAT tape of, you know, it was just somebody sitting in the audience that like recorded the show. So that was kind of the first way I got to hear Recovering the Satellites. So as technology has progressed, like, it must be pretty interesting for you, because the feedback, as we know now, got a lot more instant after that. So it's got to be interesting for you, like, how fast you can get that feedback in a way that you maybe couldn't necessarily back then.
Well, that year you're talking about, what I really remember from that year when we were making Recovering the Satellites, and in the months before that, was I had just moved to LA, and I remember discovering that AOL had these message boards for the different bands. And so I went on them and I was reading all this stuff, and all these people were really freaked out on the Counting Crows message board. Are they ever going to make a record again? Are they breaking up? Is Adam quitting the band, or what's going on? Everybody had questions, and I realized, oh, I have all the answers. I can answer all their questions. All I have to do is sign in the message board and convince them it's me. And because before that, you had to go through the press and hope your message wasn't diluted, or you had to go through the radio stations. And that was your only way of connecting with your fans, was through these kind of gatekeepers. And I remember sitting there at my computer on a dial-up modem and realizing, oh, I can answer personally all their questions. I can talk to all these people every day this week if I want to, you know, and going on there and writing. And it took me a little while to convince them that it was me. But we started this community on that at that point. This is pre any kind of social media, you know? And I just remember the thought was, wow, this has the possibility of connecting me directly to everyone in the world for free. No advertisements, no payola radio stations, no begging for favor. It's just, you can just talk to them. And I thought, oh, this internet thing is great. And I really dedicated myself to being on that message board back then. That was, you know, I remember it was in the months that year when we were, before we started recording, and then while we were making Recovering the Satellites, that realization that this thing is going to make everything different, you know? And so when Twitter came along, I jumped on that. Like, I built our thing up into a couple million really early on. I'd missed the boat on Instagram and TikTok. I was behind on that. But, you know, you get older and you just don't recognize as quickly as you did. And also, like, your life becomes consumed by things other than your social media. For sure. A while there, I was really on it.
Yeah. 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 I mean, going back to what you said about those message boards, that had to be pretty wild for you, that like you guys have like had the incredible run that you had with August and everything after. And there's people going, I wonder if these guys are ever going to do anything again. Like, you know, it's like, it's interesting that the, but you understand it as a fan, like, but it's interesting the questions that people come up with as fans.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've always toured for so long after every record that it was impossible for the next record to come that quickly. And after that first record, I mean, I kind of flipped out, so I needed a break. So even after a year and a half on the road, I probably took 6 months away from the band where I just told the guys, I'm not in a band right now, don't call me. You know, so I really understood why the fans were like that, because it had been 2 years at that point since August.
I mean, yeah, for the first four records. Time.
Yeah. I mean, for the first four records, is about 3 years between records for every record, because we would tour for a year and a half, take a little bit of time off, and then make a record. It takes a little bit to put it out, and it would always be 3 years. A little longer now sometimes, you know.
Yeah. You know, I really enjoyed the initial Butter Miracle Sweet One EP when it was released in 2021, and it seems like you took a certain path because you had an album in mind, but with the EP, it's almost like we got a look at a slice of it. And knowing how prolific you can be as a writer, like, it seems like it would be an interesting process to arrive at where we are now with a full album. Were these additional songs already around as well? Like, what did the trajectory of this whole thing look like?
No, you know, when I wrote The Suite, it was just a challenge to do this kind of musical composition of these songs that flow through each other. There was never any intention to do anything other than that. It was just this, I kind of wanted to try to write this kind of a composition. And I was very excited about doing it, and it was hard, and I was thrilled with how it turned out, and I had no plans to do anything else. But then I started, you know, it's only kind of half a record, so maybe I should. And I went right after that, and I wrote all that on my friend's farm in England. I was spending a lot of time like in the woods, you know, and I went back there the next year and did the same thing and wrote all these songs. And on my way home, I stopped in London. Some friends of mine were recording their record, this band Gang of Youths. And I'd already sung on the record once, but they had scrapped the record and started it over. So I went to sing on it again. And then I went home. And when I got home, a little while after I got there, David Leopepe, the singer, sent me the finished record. And when I heard it, I realized, oh, this is great. And I don't think I've hit this bar with these new songs. Like, they're not good enough. They need some work. And so I went back. I didn't throw them out or anything. You know, I thought Virginia Through the Rain was great, period. Spaceman in Tulsa, I really tightened it up. It had too many parts, too many sections. And I tightened it up and fixed the lyrics, got them, really honed them down. With Under the Aurora was a different song. I kept all the verses, but I rewrote the choruses and made what Under the Aurora. Boxcars, wow. On a lot of these songs I had written, it's like I was writing songs that were kind of past my ability to play. I'm not a great piano player or anything. And like I had the ideas for these songs and I knew how they went, but I couldn't play them on the piano. And I think that contributed to me, even once I'd done some of the rewriting, not being sure how good they were. And I sat with them for 2 years after that. They just sat there because I wasn't confident about them. And I didn't even send them to the band, I don't think. And then what happened was I wrote With Love From A to Z, which is the only one of the songs that was written here at home. And when I wrote that, I went back and looked at the other songs and I called up Immer, our guitar player, and Millard and Jim, our bass player and drummer, and I said, I need you guys to come to my house. And I need to play these songs with you so I can figure out if they're any good. I feel like they are, but I can't play them and I can't tell. And I hear them as a band and all I can do is play them on the piano, if at all. And so they came a few weeks later, it's like in January, and we just started demoing them. Or February, and each time we do a song, it was like, oh, fuck, that's great. I love that song. I love Spaceman in Tulsa. Aurora was so cool with the rewrites. You know, Virginia Through the Rain was beautiful. And like Boxcars, I hadn't even been able to finish it because it was such a guitar song to me that I couldn't play it well enough to write over it. And so I didn't even finish it until that week when we were in the house and the guys were playing it. And I was like, fuck, this song's so good. Now I get it. I had the chorus done kind of, and I finished it right there. And With Love From A to Z was my favorite. And it was just so right. And we were so excited coming out of that week at my house, demoing all that stuff, that we went into the studio to record it like 2 weeks later and, 2 or 3 weeks later in March, we did it in like 11 days, maybe 10 days. It was all done. It was really quick. Yeah. And it just, you know, it would have been these records, both the suite and this, were the quickest recordings we've ever done. The suite was done in 2 weeks and the Sweet Tooth, the side A, was 11 days, 12 days, maybe. But there was this huge chunk of time in between the two where I was sitting on the songs for Sweet Tooth, unsure if they were any good. Like, I have never in my life done this thing where I wrote a bunch of songs and then realized they weren't good enough like that. It's never happened to me before in my life. I'm glad I did because they needed the work and they're great now. But it was, yeah, it's really weird because, like, you know, the other thing is when I was writing them, I was trying to figure out whether they should be a suite as well, whether I wanted to write connecting parts so that it was two different suites. But I just decided I loved them the way they were. And it didn't need to be two sides of all suites. There was no real reason for it except to do it.
Yeah.
With Boxcars, you know, being kind of one of the last songs that you finished, I don't know if you find this, but it does seem like there is some sort of magic with like that last minute song that's like the last one to be finished sometimes with a lot of bands. Like, have you found that traditionally at all, like in your history writing for your band? Like, because it's just like
Sometimes.
you hear, yeah, okay.
I mean, there were songs that were written right at the end. I mean, like A Long December was written in the middle of recording that record. What else was that way? Oh, Holiday in Spain for sure. I didn't write it until we were already mixing the record. We recorded that like whimsically that day. I don't remember if there's anything from Desert Light that was that way, but yeah, it happens. I wrote about half of Desert Light and half of Hard Candy in the studio. Boxcars is a funny one to me because Boxcars I started writing during the pandemic, but I mean, I shouldn't say that. I didn't really, but I had this guitar riff in my head. You know, there was 2 years there where I couldn't play at all because we were locked, you know, we're shut down. And I was running around the house going, na 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 it was a I shouldn't say it. That's not what I was doing. What I was doing was going coronavirus, coronavirus, coronavirus. I mean, living in New York during the pandemic was scary, you know, and
Yeah.
I had just, you know, you needed ways to like loosen up, and I had this joke. I was running around the house playing this guitar riff that I called coronavirus and singing it around the house. And then I just really, I realized, wow, this is such a great guitar riff, you know, but I mean, it's ridiculous as a song. I can't really call it coronavirus and write a song around this. But I love this guitar riff. And then a while later, when I wrote kind of the verse and chorus music to Boxcars, I was thinking, oh man, you know what would be really great around this is that coronavirus riff. Like the fact that it came back to life, this ridiculous thing that I was running around the house humming to myself like an earworm for 2 years while I was locked here, just me and Zoe by ourselves, driving Zoe crazy because I'm like, coronavirus, coronavirus. The fact that
It's like she's stuck in some bad SNL episode.
And the fact that it came back to life as the riff for this song, but I really wasn't sure until the band, that was when I really couldn't tell until the band got here. I'm like, well, I think this works great as the intro riff, as the signature riff for this song. You guys play it, let me hear it. And it was fucking magic, you know?
You know, if we look at that initial suite, like it's challenging to write long form the way you did with that suite. And I've been talking to a good number of prog rock folks recently, so it's always interesting to dig into their process. I wondered, like, that maybe as I thought about that one word made me wonder, like, how much were you into the prog rock thing growing up, and how much were bands like that instructive when it came to you putting together the four songs that you did, you know, in a suite type of fashion the way you did with that?
Well, I mean, I listened to everything as a kid. So that includes, you know, The Land Lies Down on Broadway, and, you know, and other, you know, certainly I listened to the Yes album. But I think this was more informed by the second side of Abbey Road, you know, the huge melody. And what is it, the first side of the Wild, the Innocent, the East Street Shuffle? You know, there's a lot
Yeah.
of record, all of What's Going On. There's a lot of records where there are music that flows like that. I don't think it was necessarily prog stuff that was influencing me there.
Yeah, it's magical though when you start hearing stuff like that as a music fan, like
Yeah.
and you're processing almost in real time, you know, that, oh, this is all connected. This is all together.
I mean, I think what happened was I hadn't written anything for a good amount of years. And I was on my friend's farm, and I got this urge to play, and I got a keyboard out there, rented a keyboard. And the first thing I wrote was The Tall Grass. And as I was working on it, I wrote it all one day. And the next day I went back to play it to see if it was really done the next morning, you know, and I was playing it through, and I got to the outro, and I started sort of messing around with the chords and playing it a little differently. And I sang this line, Bobby was a kid from around the town. Oh, I was like, oh, I really like that, you know. And I thought, oh, maybe this is like Palisades Park, where it's a longer song than I think it is, and it has several movements to it. And this is another movement to the song. And as I worked on it with that latter part, I realized, no, this isn't the longer part of this song. This is a different song. You know, it became Elevator Boots, obviously. And as I was writing Elevator Boots, I was like, well, this is a totally different song, but isn't it cool the way it just flowed right out of that first song? And then I thought, what if I write a whole series of these where each new song is informed by the one that came before it, you know? And so I then, after I wrote Elevator Boots, I worked my way from the outro that I designed for that into what became Angel of 14th Street, you know? And then that led me right into the big power chords for Bobby and the Rat Kings. And each song seemed to kind of determine where the next song was going to go. But it really began with just that accident playing through the end of the Tall Grass and ending up in what became Elevator Boots, you know? And then I was like, this would be a really cool challenge. What if I made, you know, as a composer, what if I challenged myself here to write a series of songs like this? But it wasn't an idea I had beforehand. It was really just because it happened on its own accidentally. And then I forced myself to.
You mentioned Virginia Through the Rain. That is a beautiful song. Did you have the title first? Because that seems like one of those titles that would have launched a bunch of ideas if it was percolating anywhere in your head.
Yeah, that was kind of the first thing. I was actually on a train traveling down to see my sister, and she lives outside of DC, and it was raining. And I just started thinking of this thing, you can barely see Virginia through the rain. Wouldn't it be interesting? Cause there's like the fact that that's a place and a name. I knew a girl named Virginia. And I was like, oh, it'd be interesting to write a song where like, it's about both things kind of, you know? And, yeah. But the first thing I had was that line, I can barely see Virginia through the rain, you know? And then I went home and started working on it. And then I didn't really finish it, I think, until I got to the farm a while later when I was writing everything else. But I had kind of the idea and maybe the music after that weekend, because I hummed some stuff into my phone on the train that day, just kind of some melodies for that part of the song. And then I started working on it again when I got home. But I didn't really write the whole thing until I was on the farm. Funny that you said that, though, because that is exactly what happened. Yeah.
No, I mean, there's some great titles on this record that it's just like, you're just like, oh, man, like if that's where you started from, you know, I mean, it's a great place to start. So
that's kind of the same thing with Spaceman in Tulsa. It kind of grew out of that line. I wrote the piece of music that was the verse into the pre-chorus. And I had that line, doesn't anybody want to be a rock and roll queen? Then the next line was actually, dress your bitch up in a diamond tiara. And what it meant was your inner bitch, that inside, the bitch inside you who wants to wear a tiara, dress your bitch up in a diamond tiara. And it was that way all the way into recording it. And a couple people in the band were like, so who's the bitch? And I was like, oh yeah, people are going to misinterpret this. They're going to think I'm talking about just some girl and I'm calling her a bitch. That's not going to work. So I changed it to dress yourself up in a diamond tiara, because it just, everyone who heard it got it wrong.
Yeah.
So, for sure. But that was the first lines I had. I had, doesn't anybody want to be a rock and roll queen? Dress your bitch up in a diamond tiara. That was the genesis of that song.
Well, here's where I'll end. And it's just another bit from your rock and roll past. It's kind of like the posters that come climbing off your walls, as they say. Your band gets tapped to fill in for Van Morrison and perform at his Rock Hall induction 93. You guys were introduced by Robbie Robertson. Like, just the bullet point details there are incredible. Like, what did that actual night feel like? That's so early in the band history.
Well, I mean, I think we're probably the only unknown band to ever play at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, I don't think there's ever been anybody else that did that. What happened was Robbie was the music director and Van wasn't coming. And so, you know, somebody in the board suggested, I think Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers or something. And Robbie said, you know, there's this band that's recording their first record right now in the Hills that I know, and they would be great for this. And
Wow.
And called us. We were in the middle of making that record. And we got the call on Sunday night. We were actually home for the weekend. We had gone back up to the Bay Area. The rehearsals were Monday and the show was Tuesday, I think. So like we got the call. We jumped in the car, stopped at Tower Records. On my dad picked me and Immer and Dave Bryson up. And or me and Immer up and Dave met us in the airport. We stopped at the Tower Records on the way to the airport and picked up a bunch of Van Morrison records just so we could kind of figure out what song we wanted to play. And we were listening to them when we got down there and chose Caravan, rehearsed it that night. And the like rehearsals were the next afternoon. We had to show up and we walk into the rehearsal space and there's like the band was Robbie on guitar and Don was on bass, Jim Keltner on drums, Ben Montench from the Heartbreakers on keyboards, standing around the room. When we walk up, we hear people playing Roadhouse Blues. It's the Doors with Eddie Vedder singing lead. Leaning against the wall when we walk in that room to the rehearsal space is Clapton and Jack Bruce. Ginger Baker's late, which is right on schedule to me. And they're all just standing around this room. Springsteen's there and John Fogerty, because John Fogerty's getting inducted. Sly and the Family Stone were getting inducted by George Clinton. Cream was getting inducted. I mean, I'm probably the first guy in my generation to see Cream because they played that night. You know, it was awesome. Etta James, Ruth Brown, all getting inducted. And so, you know, it was pretty wild. It was a cool crowd to get to hang out with as a guy who's a complete unknown kid. You know, like, I was like, this is really cool.
Last thing related to that is, like, how had you guys connected with Robbie Robertson? Like, how did he know you guys?
R&R guy knew Robbie and took us to meet him before we started making the record. You know, I was really nervous about, we had not been a band for very long and we got signed, a few months.
Yeah.
And I was really nervous about us going into a studio and everybody getting intimidated by being in a big recording studio and trying to play perfectly instead of good, you know, and making this really sterile record. And when we were talking to Robbie, I told him about my concern. And he said, well, why don't you just go make a record in a house? That's what we did. And then it's not as intimidating. It's your studio. It doesn't have anything to do with anybody else. And everyone can relax. And I thought, oh man, that is a great fucking idea. And that's what we did for the first four records. We made them, we rented these houses and built our own studios.
Well, Adam, always so fun to talk tunes with you. Congrats on this new record. It's fans are really going to dig this, I think. But thank you for the time. I'll let you run.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.